Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
County, Pennsylvania, was unknown to paranormal enthusiasts until the Kevin Paul Amazon bestseller, Haunted Hills and Hollows, What Lurks in Greene County, Pennsylvania, revealed the phenomena lurking in and the haunted history of the southwestern corner of the Keystone State. Even more high strangeness can be found in Book 2 of the series, Kevin Paul's Haunted Hills and Hollows 2, still lurking in Greene County, Pennsylvania. One thing is certain, it is nearly impossible to be alone in Greene County. These riveting books, Haunted Hills and Hollows, and Haunted Hills and Hollows 2, by author Kevin Paul, in paperback, Kindle, and audiobooks, are available now on Amazon. Is your mind really a time machine? Can you change your past, erasing your past mistakes? Can you visit parallel future realities, drawing your goals to you like magic? At Harvard University, brain imaging techniques prove the human brain is a time machine. Astrophysicist Michio Kaku says thinking is really time traveling. A book called Mind, Time, and Power by Anthony Hamilton is loaded with amazing new insights and jam-packed with thought exercises to build your brain like an athlete builds his biceps. It's the new psychology for the 21st century. Get and read Mind, Time, and Power by Anthony Hamilton. Available on Amazon or at mindtimeandpower.com.
Are you looking to learn more about survival and preparedness? Look no further. The Survival Summit has you covered. The Survival Summit has produced some of the best instructional films on wilderness survival, wilderness medical, escape and evasion, land navigation, survival communications, and much more. We also carry a wide selection of survival gear to help you on your journey to preparedness. Looking for bigger discounts? We have a monthly subscription plan that will give you immediate access to all of our films as online streaming, plus 20% off all of our products. Be sure to check us out today at thesurvivalsummit.com. That's thesurvivalsummit.com.
Do you remember how great paranormal talk radio was in the 80s and 90s? Night Dreams Talk Radio brings back to you talk radio like you remember, with your host, Gary Anderson, broadcasting to you live from his secret compound deep in the great Northwest. Now, here's Gary.
Well, here I am. I can't believe it's April 4th. Well, not that far away from the deadline. If you owe money to the IRS, well, you know, a lot of strange things is going on in the news. But before that, I just want to welcome our new sponsor for the show, the Survival Summit. Check out, well, their videos on our website at www.nightdreamstalkradio.com. You know, now is more than ever that you should be prepared, because we could have a solar flare which could take out our grid system or whatever. It could be a national disaster of all kinds. You should be prepared. Have enough food, have medical supplies, and check out the Survival Summit. Well, in the news, kind of a lot of crazy things going. The Navy last month reported, well, two of their ships were chased by balls of light. That just came out in today's news, but this happened a month ago. And they thought it maybe was drones, but none of their weapons on the ships could even take out those balls of light. So who knows? Maybe they were holograms. I have no idea. But again, in the news, last week we were talking about solar storms, and we thought, gee, it's over with. Well, NASA just said this week, be prepared. There's another one, and it's always a possibility it could take out part of the grid, depending on where you live. I mean, that is getting more and more interesting with these solar flares. The sun is aimed right at us, so it's like dead on. And normally it's firing out these flares every which way, but not coming towards Earth. Well, the end of the world warning for millions of animals that could disappear off our planet by 2030. And that's because our planet is warming up and a lot of other things going on. Well, also, could you imagine a bird? It's about 5 or 6 feet tall. Strong enough to actually tear the heads off of crocodiles, baby crocodiles, that is. And that is the shoe-billed bird. And I was looking at it. It kind of looks like a dodo bird, you know, prehistoric type of thing. Well, tonight we got a great show. If you have kids, maybe this is not the time to let them listen to the show. Maybe go send them in the other room, you know, get them to watch TV. We're going to talk about, well, with Steve Starr, Professor Steve Starr, what would this planet look like? What would the United States look like if we had a nuclear exchange? Stay tuned. We'll be right back. You're listening to Night Dreams Talk Radio.
Echoes of Eden by Paul Wallace. What secrets of human potential lie hidden in the world's ancestral narratives? How are they connected with God, the Bible, and ET contact? From U.S. Senate briefings to ancient African ceremonies, from strange phenomena in Australia and Iraq to anomalies in Brazil and ancient Greece, the Eden series takes you around the world to discover why governments, military, and intelligence are interested in archaeology and initiation practices, and why you should be too. And what are the implications for you and me? To buy Echoes of Eden, The Scars of Eden, and Escaping from Eden, go to Amazon, Kindle, Barnes & Noble, and wherever books are sold. Echoes of Eden is endorsed by George Noory. Paul has done it again with his Eden series, delving deep into the power of the mind to do incredible things.
Hi, this is Val Von Torn of Metatron Power and Light. You're listening to Gary Anderson and Night Dreams Talk Radio.
Well, thank you, Val. Well, James, what can you tell the listeners about our guest tonight?
Well, our guest tonight is Stephen Starr, Professor Stephen Starr. And Stephen has been a clinical laboratory science program director and assistant clinical professor associate and Nuclear Age Peace Foundation former board member. Now, Stephen knows everything nuclear from A to Z, pretty much. And you can check out his website, nuclearfamine.org.
Well, Professor Steve, how are you doing, my friend? It's been a long time since you've been on the show.
I'm good, Gary. I appreciate you having me back.
Well, here's the thing. What is the difference between these nuclear devices? I mean, compared to what happened in Hiroshima back during World War II, and, you know, what are we looking at? Are they going to take out like a mile, a couple blocks, or what types of are these devices nowadays?
I think that's a good place to start. You know, I teach a class at the University of Missouri every summer, and the students that I have that come into the class are really very bright, but they've never been taught about nuclear weapons at all in school. So the Hiroshima bomb, those are sort of entry-level, the first nuclear weapons that people would come up with when they're trying to start a program. They're still, about 1,000 times more powerful than the largest conventional or like a high-explosive device. The Hiroshima bomb had an explosive power. They measure it in thousands of tons of TNT. They call it a kiloton. So Hiroshima had 15,000 tons or 15 kilotons of explosive power. That was, but, you know, just talking about explosive powers doesn't really do justice. It's a nuclear weapon is like a piece of the sun, essentially. And that a 15 kiloton weapon will essentially start fires over about a 3 to 5 square mile area. And those all combine into a gigantic mass fire. And anything that's in that fire zone is not going to survive. There were some mass fires that we had in Hamburg and Dresden that we used with, you know, firebombing raids. They weren't as large, but so then in the 1950s, they came up with the hydrogen bomb, which is about 1,000 times more powerful than an atomic bomb. So that's then makes it about 1 million times more powerful than a regular conventional weapon. The Now they call those thermonuclear weapons nowadays. But the average thermonuclear weapon that the U.S. and Russia has is usually between 7 and 85 times more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb was. Yeah. I wrote an article for the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists about the effects of it would be a standard Russian warhead. It's an 800 kiloton, 800,000 tons of TNT, explosive equivalent. But when you detonate that, in about 1 second, you have a fireball that's about a mile in diameter, and the surface of it is about 4,000 degrees hotter than the surface of the sun, like 16,000 degrees Fahrenheit. And that will set fires over a 100 to 150 square mile area instantly. Anything in the that's flammable in that fire zone is going to be ignited. So that gives you an idea. The U.S. has... U.S. has something like 800 to 1,000. Our weapons are not quite that large. Their standard is like 300 to 330 kilotons. The largest sub-weapon is 450 kilotons. But Russia has about 600 to the 800 kiloton weapons and a couple, several hundred more of the 100 kiloton weapons. That each side can launch those in a matter of 2 to 15 minutes. They call them launch-ready nuclear weapons. And the Russian president and the American president are both followed around by military officers that have what they call a nuclear briefcase, which is sort of an automated communication device that gives the president the ability to give the permission order to launch a nuclear attack.
That is scary. I was reading that they really would like to even tighten that up a little bit. What's your feelings on that?
Well, it's, you know, the problem with... having a nuclear arsenal is that, you know.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You're always supposed to be ready to use it at any instant, right? But then you also don't want it to be used unless it's authorized. You don't want an accidental nuclear war. And I wrote about that some years ago because, you know, when there's high tensions like there are now, and Russia's early warning system isn't exactly in really good shape compared to ours. They lost a lot of their satellites that have been replaced. So they, if they get a warning of attack, this is from electronic warning signals from like, if it's a false warning of attack and they believe it to be true, then they can launch, they'll launch their weapons conceivably before that attack arrives. And then if it's a false warning of attack, then they basically just started a nuclear war. So in other words, I guess what I'm trying to say is that they don't want to make it too easy to launch, but they also have to make it very easy to launch. So it's always, I've always felt like that was a danger that you couldn't get away from.
You know what scares me, and you know, I've gotten a lot of emails, you know, from our listeners about this, is the hypersonic missiles that are, you know, China and Russia have.
Right.
And at this point, well, I don't know. You can't trust everything you read naturally on the news, but I know some people high up in the military, and they said at this point we could, the odds are shooting one down or taking one out is very almost impossible.
Right. There's a Russian, he was a formal naval officer in Russia, and he's a military analyst. His name's Andrei Martianov, and he's got a blog. And he's written a couple of books on this, and one of his last ones was called The Real Revolution in Military Affairs. And he was essentially documenting the fact that the U.S. is not a few years, but a few generations behind Russia in hypersonic weapons. And also, not only that, but in electronic warfare and missile defense systems. Our Patriot missile system pales in comparison to their S-400 and S-500. I honestly think part of the reason Russia decided to do their war that they're having now is because they felt like that they were at the point where they have Kinzhal missiles that travel 9 to 10 times the speed of sound, and they use some of those on Ukraine already. We can't intercept those at all. The Russians hit two NATO bases in western Ukraine, and they hit them with missiles, and there was no warning of the attack. They didn't even see them coming. So, yeah, we're very much at risk from those. I mean, though, even if you go back to basic ICBMs, there's always been an issue of when you can build decoys into a warhead, and you can launch that. So when the warhead gets into outer space and detaches from the missile, all these decoys spread out from it. And so unless you're using a nuclear weapon to intercept that, you really don't know which one to target. You know, and so the whole issue of trying to defend against a nuclear attack has always been sort of a questionable, which is why they signed the anti-ballistic missile treaty back when, but you know, we pulled out of that some time ago, 2003, I guess.
Well, you know, it scares me, these nuclear warheads, correct me, they can have multiple capabilities of taking out a big area. You know, a lot of people think, oh, it's only going to be one or two. It could be multiple of a lot of them, couldn't it?
Yeah, you're talking about multiple independent reentry vehicles, or MIRVs, they call them. And that was something they came up with about 20 or 30 years ago that allowed one warhead to carry 8 to 10. Now the new Russian ICBM can carry up to 20 independently targetable warheads. And the other issue is, like, our missile defense system is based on a ballistic trajectory. You know, it's called ballistic missile defense. A ballistic trajectory is like a parabola. It's a predictable, goes up and comes down, and it follows, you know, a predictable course. The Russian systems that they've come out with now are maneuverable. They have maneuverable warheads. I mean, they have a lot of stuff. And Putin came out in 2018 talked about four or five new weapon systems that they have. But the fact that they have maneuverable warheads means that a ballistic missile defense won't work against those. So we don't have a defense against Russian warheads.
Well, do they have a defense against ours?
Well, that's a good question. I don't want to find out the hard way, though. You know.
Yeah. Well, who does? That's what scares me, because when we were talking about, you know, before we went on the air, I'm about 13 miles away from Bangor, which, you know, that is where all the nuke subs are. They also store nuclear weapons there. Manchester, it's a Navy fuel depot, plus they carry nuclear weapons there. And then I'm actually about 13 to 14 miles away from Accord, Fort Lewis, the joint base, you know, which is naturally a major Air Force base and a large Army base. And again, I mean, if we were going to be attacked, and if you go by the waterway, you know, rather than driving, I'm maybe 10 miles away from Seattle if I could just go a straight course through the water.
Right. Well, you know, that 800 kiloton warhead, when it detonates, if you're 7 miles away from it and you're exposed to the fireball, you have instant third-degree burns to your skin. The fireball would appear 300 times brighter than the desert sun at noon. So, you know, these weapons are immense. They're almost unimaginable. It's just like suddenly being enveloped in a wall of fire. You know, so I think my suggestion is if we actually get into a direct military conflict with Russia, it might be a good idea to go stay someplace in the mountains for a while.
Yeah, but how are you going to get there? Haven't you ever seen these movies on TV? Gridlock, you know, I don't have a helicopter. I don't have a plane. You know, I mean, you try to get out from, you know, where I'm at to any place of the mountains. I mean, the freeways and all this stuff are going to be just dead stop.
Well, I don't want to give the impression that, I mean, really, you know, if you have a couple of cities that are hit with nuclear weapons, it would be just an incredible nightmare. It would kill more people than it killed in any wars we've had. It'd probably, you know, the economy, everything would be collapsed. But, you know, I mean, Russia, you know, we can each launch 800 to 1,000 nuclear warheads in 15 minutes. And so if they start doing that, then I think we have 300 and some cities that have populations of greater than 100,000, and Russia has 200 and some. So it won't take very many, you know, just a tenth of the warheads, 20% of them can take out every major city we have. So, that's why we just can't do this. That's why it's absolutely important to not get into a direct military conflict with Russia don't get suckered into some no-fly zone. Don't send troops, you know, from Poland into Ukraine. I mean, that doesn't appeal to somebody that wants to fight, but we can't. If you shoot one nuclear weapon off against another nuclear weapon state like Russia, then are you going to assume they won't shoot one back? And then what happens? You shoot two and they shoot two? I mean, you know, it wouldn't take very long for all hell to break loose, literally. So,
well, in a case like the Ukraine, what happens if they decide to just send a small tactical one in the Ukraine somewhere? Just to make a point, as whatever they're, I don't even know what they're doing logically. I mean, you know, this is the most weirdest situation I think this world has faced, you know, to invade the Ukraine. It's worse than what Hitler did during World War II, where he sent his troops in with no winter gear, and a lot of them just froze to death. They thought they could come in and within 3 days conquer the Ukraine. And it's not working that way. I don't know what the whole thoughts were. And I'm not getting into the political military side, but they do have advanced military weapons, but yet they have sent old obsolete equipment. They sent troops that weren't prepared. They didn't have enough fuel line, food, and it's weird. And then you see the Russian troops, a lot of them are actually, you know, surrendering and saying, hey, we'll go on your side. You know, this is the most bizarre war situation I've ever seen in my life.
Well, I've been very interested in it, obviously, for, you know, when you know a lot about nuclear weapons, it's hard not to be interested in what's going on when Russia's fighting a war in Europe. I don't know what to believe in terms of most of the reports we get in our news come from Ukrainian sources. And, you know, I'm not saying Russia's not going to put out propaganda too, but I don't really know the accuracy of a lot of this. I think from what I have read, that Russia has held back something like 60 or 80% of its troops, and they could send more in if they wanted to, but, I don't know. I don't want to argue about what's going on there. I think that the real danger is if NATO gets involved, as far as we're concerned, as far as a nuclear war is concerned. So I hope that doesn't happen.
Well, I hope it don't either. And then let's be honest with you. We have somebody in North Korea that now has perfected a ballistic missile that can reach anywhere in the United States.
Right.
That scares me.
Strategic weapon. They've tested weapons. The last weapons test was a couple hundred kilotons, I believe. So that's a lot bigger than an atomic bomb. So, you know, when you were talking about before I came on, you were talking about the solar flare, the coronal mass ejection that might mess up the grid. And you know, I've been writing a book for about almost 2.5 years now on the effects of electromagnetic pulse from a high altitude nuclear detonation. I could talk about that. I'm not sure if I should start now or if we've got another half hour, I think.
Well, we got to take a break in about 3 minutes. But, you know, that is one thing people don't realize. Our grid system is so outdated. You know, Congress appropriated some money to shore it up, but it's not enough. And this is something that should have been shored up years ago. And a lot of people don't realize this past winter, Texas almost lost their whole grid. And a lot of people don't realize if our grid system goes down, it's not going to be, if it really went down, if something took it out, which I think we're going to talk about after this break, I don't see it coming back up for a year or two or more.
The solar flare and the electromagnetic pulse can take out the large power transformers. And if it does that, those are almost all made overseas, anything greater than 100 kilowatts. And so, it takes 2 to 3 years to have those manufactured and installed. And so we could have you could have large areas down for well over a year.
Oh yeah. There'll be pockets of the grid up in, you know, different parts of the country, but overall it's going to take out the grid. And a lot of people don't realize the transformers are not made in this country because of the, you know, toxic oils and stuff that's used to cool the windings in the transformer. And they're handmade in places like India, where they don't have the laws and where people can, you know, handling it are going to naturally come down with cancer and all this other stuff. And that, you're right. When I talked to our local power company up here, and they told me that if anything major happened, they couldn't fix it. And if a major transformer went out, there's no way they would even have one. And they said what they do have in stock to order other ones, you're right, about 2 years to get it.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, the utility companies have fought against, there were bills in Congress that were trying to actually add protection to protect the transformers from solar flares and EMP, but the electric utilities have torpedoed it twice because they don't want to spend the money on it.
Well, yeah, but we can spend the money, you know, Professor Steve, on everything else.
Yeah, I know.
And we can't shirk the wall. You know, I'd be more, you know, we were so worried. And you don't hear anything about the wall, right, anymore.
Right.
But you know what? That all that money spent on the wall, I would have liked to seen it on our grid system. I mean, that is the most important. Well, Professor Steve, we'll be back in about 3 minutes. Okay, we're going to talk about what could happen to all our power if something was detonated above us. So stay tuned. You're listening to Night Dreams Talk Radio.
Are you looking to learn more about survival and preparedness? Look no further. The Survival Summit has you covered. The Survival Summit has produced some of the best instructional films on wilderness survival, wilderness medical, escape and evasion, land navigation, survival communications, and much more. We also carry a wide selection of survival gear to help you on your journey to preparedness. Looking for bigger discounts? We have a monthly subscription plan that will give you immediate access to all of our films as online streaming, plus 20% off all of our products. Be sure to check us out today at thesurvivalsummit.com. That's thesurvivalsummit.com.
Meet the Totally Ninja Raccoons. Three raccoons who become ninjas because they already have the masks. The Totally Ninja Raccoons books are short adventures with quick chapters, specially structured to encourage reluctant readers. Each book has the Totally Ninja Raccoons encountering a cryptid. The monsters are presented in a fun, not so scary way.
I said not so scary!
Readers are encouraged to do their own research and make up their own minds about the possible existence of Bigfoot, the Jersey Devil, aliens, and more. The Totally Ninja Raccoons are available on Amazon or at your favorite bookstore. You can buy autographed copies direct from the author at kevincoolidge.org. That's kevincoolidge.org for the Totally Ninja Raccoons. Longtime UFO and Bigfoot researcher Stan Gordon is releasing his fourth casebook called Creepy Cryptids and Strange UFO Encounters of Pennsylvania. Included are many cases from across his decades of research, from Bigfoot to giant.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Giant flying creatures, mini UFOs, aquatic beasts, to hairless, sickly-looking humanoids. Enjoy a journey into a realm that suggests that present-day sightings of monsters might be real, mystifying creatures, none of which are supposed to exist. Some cases include one of the creepiest crawling cryptids of all time. Was there an even stranger Mothman encounter near Pittsburgh in 1966? The small Bigfoot and the strange sphere of light. Tall, hairless humanoid with glowing yellow eyes that follows man to his house. Stan presents some startling cases that suggest that some of the unknown creatures being reported may be much stranger than just flesh and blood. Could some UFOs and even some cryptids possibly be visitors from another dimension? Order your copy now of Creepy Cryptids and Strange UFO Encounters of Pennsylvania.
Stan's new book, as well as his other case books, are available online at Amazon and Barnes & Noble, or visit his website at www.stangordon.info.
I occasionally think how quickly our differences worldwide would vanish if we were facing an alien threat from outside this world. And yet, I ask you, is not an alien force already among us?
Night Dreams brings on the night worldwide. Did you know you can find us on your favorite app? And now you can watch us live on YouTube. Make sure you subscribe to our channel and give us a thumbs up. And now, here's Gary.
And here I am with Professor Steve Starr. Well, you know, I got to ask you a question. If somebody was dumb enough to detonate over the United States a nuclear thermal device, what would happen?
If it was detonated above the lower atmosphere, somewhere like about 40 to 60 miles up, instantly, in about a billionth of a second, there's an E1 component of the electromagnetic pulse that would destroy all the integrated circuits in an area at least the size of the state of Missouri or larger. And beyond that, it would also several seconds later have an E3 component of that EMP pulse that would take out all the large power transformers in like an entire regions. They've said that they've confirmed by all means of measurement that the threat posed by electromagnetic pulse and also the geomagnetic disturbance that you mentioned, the solar flare, they exceed the intended stress limit for the U.S. power network. So almost instantly the grid would go down and it would probably go down nationwide. It would start maybe quickly in one region and then it would knock it out. And that's just one nuclear detonation. If there are two or three, then you would certainly have that effect over for the grid.
That is really scary when you think about that.
Yeah, I've had a concern about what would happen in nuclear power plants, partially because I had a background in nuclear engineering. But I've spent a couple years doing research on this with a guy that's written like 540 peer-reviewed papers. So he put up with all my questions. It's a complicated phenomenon to understand, but basically there's no question that the integrated circuits, and those are found in everything. You know, every modern electronic device, whether it's a laptop computer, a modem, anything that's got a capacitor, a relay, they all have these microchips or integrated circuits, and they operate at a few volts. And so this EMP pulse, the E1, it comes down in like 50,000 volts per square meter. And that's with not an enhanced nuclear weapon. The Chinese and Russian military textbooks say that they can produce 2 to 4 times that much. But let's just assume that it's 50,000 volts per meter and the Strategic Air Command was worried about that basically because they didn't want that to knock out their communication systems. So they actually have. I was talking to a major in the Air Force, and we were going to do a panel at the UN, but he got told he couldn't participate 3 weeks before the panel. But he told me that they do have software. The Air Force uses software that shows that in an area about the size of Dallas-Fort Worth, which is like 9,200 square miles, would have all the integrated circuits destroyed instantly. So that's destroyed. So if you go out further to disable, you can get a huge geographic areas, you know, 70,000, 100,000 square miles where, and so everything there, you know, all the critical infrastructure that uses integrated circuits would be ground, sea, rail, air transportation, fuel and food distribution systems, water, sanitation systems, telecommunication, banking, financial transactions, emergency services, all those would be knocked out. You wouldn't be able to turn on the water, your heat, couldn't use the phone, you couldn't pump gas out of a pump, you couldn't, you know, flush a toilet. And that's I think that's pretty important. There are actually devices that can be, you can shield a nuclear power plant, and you can also shield, you know, if I mentioned nuclear power plants, what had happened with those would destroy or disable the emergency cooling systems and the emergency power backup systems in those. And so, you know, basically the reactors would melt down in 30 minutes to an hour if those don't function. So you could knock out 12 to 25 reactors all at once.
Well, Steve, here's the thing you think about. You know, unless you have a 59 Edsel, and that's a joke, you could start that car up. But anything made from the mid-70s up would have, you know, integrated circuits in it. The car isn't going to start. Trucks aren't going to start. You're not going to get food going into the grocery stores. The grocery stores aren't going to open up anyway because none of their computers or anything are going to work. You're not going to go to your ATM machine and pull cash out. I mean, it would be a really put us almost back to the Stone Age really fast.
It's hard to believe. You know, one of the problems is that this whole issue has been identified as like a neocon issue. And so it gets dismissed as like, oh, there they go again with this EMP. But that's not scientifically correct. You know, I really have made an effort to try to understand how these things work. And I focus on nuclear power plants because if you can imagine 25 nuclear power plants melting down at the same time, if they detonated a weapon like that over France, they'll probably have 50 nuclear reactors melt down at the same time. So then you just have the whole place become uninhabitable from radioactivity. But yeah, beyond that, if nothing works that, you know, we can't can't get a drink or go to the bathroom or eat or anything, then, you know, we're back in the 18th century instantly or 17th century, only we don't have the skills that the people had back then to deal with all that.
That's the scary part. People don't have the skills. You know, they don't know how to produce water. The majority of people don't. And if you were in the situation, I'll be honest with you, you're out in the middle of nowhere. How do you start a fire? A lot of people don't even know how to do the basics and how to survive. And that's what I'm worried about. Not just a nuclear exchange, but we got the solar flares. And, you know, so many years, Congress, just like I said, we don't need the money. We need the money this way, the money that way. Well, if we got hit with a solar flare, which we're playing craps.
We are. There are technological fixes for the large power transformers. You know, the transformers are used to distribute electricity. You know, you got to get it from where they generate the electricity to, they, you know, 50, 100, 200 miles to where the users. And if you don't have the large power transformers, you can't. It doesn't work. That's when the grid goes down. But it'll cost about $1 billion to protect all the large power transformers in the U.S. They know how to do it. They've had a couple of acts in Congress where they were trying to mandate it. But the electric utilities have fought it tooth and nail because they don't want to spend the money on it. And I mean, I can understand that from their standpoint, but if we can spend, you know, $1 billion on like one plane or something or whatever, an aircraft carrier, surely we could spend the money to protect the grid. And you can also protect nuclear power plants by shielding. And it wouldn't be, there's a question about how thoroughly you could do it. But, you know, it's just, I mean, first of all, we shouldn't let this happen. But the fact is there's like over 13,000 nuclear weapons in the world. And it's pretty hard to guarantee that one of them is not going to go off somewhere or another. And the major in the Air Force that I talked to, he wrote a paper about it. You could even use a weather balloon to lift one over the U.S. You smuggled one in. You can send stuff to a bonded warehouse in the United States where it's not searched until it comes out of the warehouse. You know, there's a lot of ways that you can, even if you're a police state, it's pretty hard to keep a nuclear weapon out of like a harbor or a port. So, you know, I just wish we could figure out how to spend more money on helping people instead of just spending so much money on defense and weapons every year.
Well, that would be nice. You know, again, you know, look at the situation we're in right now. It is scary, and it's going to get more scary. We're all going to go for a ride. But then you add this up. You know, I am 70 years old. I don't know how old you are, Professor Steve, but, you know, I grew
<The same age. laughs>
I grew up, you know, I grew up in the Cold War. And
yeah,
I tell you,
cover, right?
it was the most ridiculous thing. Get underneath your desk at school, like that's going to save your life. Or Ronald Reagan did basically a goodbye video, which hit and was taken off really fast because I think people realized it was the most illogical thing anybody ever could have done, especially a politician, where he told people to dig a hole in the ground, remove doors from your house. And then, you know, put your family and loved ones in this hole and put 3 feet of dirt above it because they figure 3 feet of dirt will shelter a certain amount of radiation. To me, that was basically, hey, a cleanup crew. Now we don't have to bury those people.
Yeah. As you could say, there's three things you can do. You can bend over, put your head between your legs, and kiss your butt goodbye. That's my suggestion if you're in a target area. No, that's kind of a bad joke, but it's grim when it gets to nuclear weapons. And you know that one of the new weapons that the Russians came up with, they have a drone torpedo that's 7 feet in diameter and about 20 or 30 feet long. And it goes faster than any of our torpedoes will go. It goes underneath the ocean, and they could detonate it. It can carry up to 100 megaton warhead that would basically destroy about 3,000 to 5,000 square miles. If they can just blast that off the coast somewhere and destroy, you know, the whole New York, New Jersey area. And, you know, the idea is don't mess with us because this is what could happen. But you know, I'm just afraid somebody's going to make a mistake or something, you know, that's going to lead to some kind of nuclear exchange. So.
Well, again, I hate to say it. North Korea is one. I'm more concerned about North Korea right now.
Yeah.
Because they're sitting back watching what's happening now between, you know, the Western, and what's happening with, you know, Russia. And they're sitting, and China's the same thing. They're watching, well, what are we going to do? Is now a good time to move into Taiwan? And then we have this person in North Korea that, you know, is basically constantly threatening to take out the United States, and he's sitting back there. Well, now I have a missile can reach anywhere in the United States. So
they
we have
like 40 to 50 nuclear weapons now, according to the nuclear notebook at the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. So.
Yeah, this is scary. This is the most scary time. And I look at my grandkids, you know, from 8 years old and up, and I'm thinking, wow, what is this doing to them? My grandson, a couple weeks ago, Professor Steve came up to me and said, you know what? We're going to burn up. The flesh is going to burn off my body. This is an 8-year-old. And I go, where did you hear that? Oh, we're going to die in a nuclear war. This is what's going to happen. This is what's going on in a lot of young kids' minds right now. That's scary.
You know, I've always felt kind of badly. I got three daughters, and they had to grow up around a lot of this. And I do want to say they're all three out in California, if they happen to be listening, that I love them and I miss them. But, you know, I've always felt badly about that because I felt like I was kind of terrorizing them in a way. I tried not to talk about it, but, you know, it was when you spend all your time working on this stuff, it's hard to not notice, you know.
Oh, it's scary. Now, where are some safe spots do you feel that if something happened, where could somebody go? I mean, I know Seattle is going to be a main thing because we got the military here. We got Boeing aircraft, you know, a lot of military stuff here in my state. But where can people go if they could, if they had the money and say, hey, I don't want to deal with this anymore. Where can they go where they maybe could live their full life out?
Well, I mean, it depends on how large a nuclear war you're talking about. You know, if it's going to be a big war, you probably ought to move to the Southern Hemisphere somewhere. And even then, you're not guaranteed. Probably someplace closer to the equator, I guess. You know, I've got my nuclearfamine.org website. I work with scientists at UCLA and University of Colorado, Boulder, and Rutgers that have written a whole series of peer-reviewed papers on what the long-term environmental consequences of nuclear war would be. And, you know, basically these enormous nuclear firestorms will produce tens and even 150 million tons of soot and smoke. And they found that the sun heats up, it's a black carbon soot. It's not like volcanic ash where it's gray and that stuff falls out in about a year, but the soot gets heated by the sun and it rises, like 80% of it gets above the cloud level into the stratosphere where there's no rain. So it doesn't rain out. The sun heats it and keeps it there for up to 10 years. And the stratosphere gets hot. It gets up to the boiling point of water up there. So that works to destroy a lot of the protective ozone layer. But the worst part really is that it blocks enough sunlight that it would be a large nuclear war between the U.S. and Russia would produce. It would decrease about 70% of the sunlight reaching the northern hemisphere. So they predict that the daily temperatures would fall below freezing every day for 1 to 3 years in the central North America and central Eurasia. So we wouldn't be able to grow crops for years. So, you know, nobody's going to survive that, really. So that's about the grimmest thing I can tell you. But I just hope to God it doesn't come to that. I mean, but even if it comes to a few nuclear weapons going off, it's still going to be all hell. If you happen to be where a nuclear weapon goes off, you know, they'll tell you to stay in a fallout shelter in a basement, you know, for about 2 weeks at least. And, you know, you got to have 2 or 3 gallons of water per day per person, and you got to have a way to take care of human waste. You got to have food. You have to have ventilation. You know, if you're in a high fallout area, you have to be able to have some filtration of the air coming in or something. You know, it's not simple. So, but when you come out, then what's left? You know, how are you going to survive after that? So I just, people need to make, what we need to do now is that you need to talk to your representatives in the White House and say, don't get involved. Don't get NATO involved. Unless NATO starts fighting Russia over in Ukraine, we're going to big trouble. So
now that's, and it scares me because, you know, again, I know some people that have nice bug out fallout shelters.
Right.
A friend of mine has an old, Nike underground. He bought one of the bunkers.
Yeah, you can buy fancy stuff if you got enough money.
You know? Yeah, and, you know, he got it really cheap. He got paid $250,000 for it. But the point is, you go into one of those, okay, and you sit in underground 6 months to a year. What are you going to come out to?
Yeah. Well, that reminds me, you know, we were about the same age. We used to have Twilight Zone shows about that, you know, and it scared me. I left a mark on me as a kid too. I think that's part of the reason why I was always sort of preoccupied with it. And I was in nuclear engineering at one point, but back then I was, I started getting worried about radioactivity and then nuclear weapons. And here I am now teaching a class on it. So,
and it's scary. You know, the reactor, it melted down in Japan. They're finding radiation in salmon, all the way up the West Coast, Washington, Oregon, California. And I had Captain Paul Watson, who did this Sea Shepherd Society, that did Whale Wars. I don't know if you're familiar with that cable show. It was on for years, where they stopped the Japan of killing, you know, the whales.
Right.
And, you know, like he said, that we are killing the ocean. People don't realize most of our oxygen is produced by the plankton in the ocean. It's not the rainforest. It's not your trees out in your yard. It's the ocean. And if we kill the ocean, we're killing ourselves.
Yeah, it's sort of an open question. If we basically fry the ozone layer, you know, India and Pakistan, they each have about 150, 160 nuclear weapons each. These scientists I mentioned on my website, I have a study that they did, kind of baseline scenario. They call it for like a war with atomic bombs. And they had a total of 100 atomic bombs detonated in the large cities of India and Pakistan. With that, would put something like 7 million tons of smoke in the stratosphere. That would actually really destroy a lot of the ozone for like 3 to 5 years. And, you know, the UV index goes up to like 11 now. They had to make a new scale for it. It would go up in the 23, 24. You could get a really bad sunburn in a matter of like, well, at least you'd get a sunburn in 7 minutes outside at noon in June from a war like that. So we just, you know, nuclear weapons are a whole different level. If they're not anything, they're really not like any weapon we have any familiarity with. And I worry that the leaders, if they even really grasp all this, because, you know, there are very few people that have even observed a nuclear detonation anymore that are still alive. And you can read about all this, but, you know, we're talking about something that's a gigantic fireball that sets 150 square miles on fire instantly. I mean, I just wonder if some of our leaders have any clue about this.
Well, sometimes I think they need to be educated or re-educated. You know, during, the 50s? I can't remember the island, but we detonated a nuclear device near an island. And, you know, the natives that we moved off on the island, you know, very unhappy because they didn't have an island anymore.
A Bikini Atoll. So we tested about 100 nuclear detonations above ground in Nevada, and that let out a vast amount of radiation over the U.S., I think it's actually caused a huge amount of thyroid cancer and all that. But the bigger weapons, like the megaton range, the hydrogen bombs, you couldn't shoot one of those off in the U.S., so they did it out in the South Pacific. There's one atoll there where they scraped up all kinds of plutonium and everything, and they covered it up with a concrete dome, but the sea level's rising. And that's one more thing that could poison the Pacific Ocean. But, yeah, those weapons are incredible. You know, you shoot off a 20-megaton bomb, and... It's the clouds, the nuclear mushroom clouds, like 60 miles across. It's not a weapon that people can even imagine. It's hard to describe to people.
So if they decided they wanted to take out Bangor, which is about 13 or so miles away from me, I mean, how many miles would I need to be away from that if it got hit to survive?
Well, I suppose you could survive at 13 miles, but you'd have to have a pretty good fallout shelter, and you'd have to stay, down there for 2 or 3 weeks at least. But you'd really want to be, even 53 miles away from a 1 megaton bomb, if you look at it at night, you go blind. You want to be very, you want to be as far away as you could. I don't know. I mean, you don't want to be like, so we have ICBM fields in Montana and North Dakota. And, you want to be those, if those all get hit, then you wouldn't be want to be around any of those. I'm downwind from the Whiteman Air Force Base here in Missouri. So we'd get a ton of fallout from that. But honestly, it's just if we get into a nuclear war with that many weapons going off, I don't know where to. I'd say you should just try to leave the country a week or two ahead of time and go someplace. Central America or Mexico or something. Try to get away from it.
Yeah. How about Canada? I mean, Canada, their population's right pretty much near the border of the U.S.
Yeah.
And if you go more outward, I mean, would you be able to survive there?
You could, I guess. I see people that go way up north as survivalists, but it's pretty damn cold up there in the winter, and they don't necessarily have great soil, and to grow your own food. And I don't want to, just to even survive up there without a nuclear war is fairly challenging, I think. So,
well, I got a cure for it. I'm gonna sign up to go to Mars. How's that?
Well, the rich people are headed to New Zealand and have bunkers there, but the Russians have said that they know where their bunkers are. They can target those too. Any of these weapons, even with conventional warheads now, they can put it through like an office window if they want to. So it's pretty hard to hide from anyone with all the surveillance systems and the targeting that they have.
Well, honestly, Professor Steve, what scares me is, you mentioned how they can actually spy on you. Right. In the last 10 years, the satellites can actually zoom in and read your license plate of your car in your driveway. That is really, really scary. This might sound kind of gross, but, about 2 years ago, I went on to, Google or whatever, one of these, and I was looking at my house. I wanted to look at my property, right?
Yeah.
Here's my wife next to the swimming pool, sunbathing, kind of topless. And I'm looking at it, and I'm going, hey, and I printed out the picture. I said, you know what? This was taken from a satellite. That was scary.
That's amazing. Yeah. Well, I'm kind of a 20th century kind of guy, and it's hard for me to keep up with everything anymore, but I've tried to stay current on all the nuclear issues. So, I just hope that they're wrong about a lot of things is all it comes down to. I hope there is no such thing as nuclear winter. I hope the climate models are wrong and all that, but they use these models to accurately predict a lot of other things, even on other planets. So it's hard for me to believe that they're that far off. And, I don't know. I care about people, and I care about all the living things on the planet, all the other animals and the life forms. And it just seems so stupid to blow everything up over some political argument that, 100 years from now, will they even remember what we were fighting over? We go back 200 or 300 years, we kind of remember the name of a king or a president, but we don't know what the hell was going on.
Well, you know what? If there's a nuclear... Boy, our time is almost up. If we had a nuclear exchange, a big one, okay? It's going to put us back to the point where, they won't even know what a civilization is. They're going to be going back to the caveman stage. And I always joke around that this Earth has been rebooted several times. And it seems like it's a cycle, and it seems like we're almost there, and it scares me. Again, I'm not going to get political, but when we have a leader of a major country living supposedly right now in a huge underground city, and he farmed out all his relatives everywhere where he feels he'll be safe, it kind of scares me that in the back of their mind they might be thinking about if it comes down to the last thing, I'm going to push the button. I don't know.
Well, the thing is, any nuclear weapon state is, they're always thinking about it. We have what we call a living, you know, well, they call it CON plan, but they used to call it the Living Strategic Integrated Operational Plan. It's constantly updated 24/7 with all the targets, information, and everything, because the president always has to be given all these different choices for where he can attack. And, you know, so we don't see it, but the submarines, they always keep like 8 submarines in position to launch. They're called hard alert status, or 6, I guess now, I'm not sure, but all this stuff's going on out of our sight. You know, and maybe that's a good thing. It'd be hard to live any kind of a normal life. I've struggled with it myself because I know too much about it, but it's all going on behind the scenes.
I don't know if I would really want to survive if I was one of the lucky ones to survive of a nuclear attack, because everything I know, everything I grew up, all my values are going to be gone. You know, I will say this. What has gone on since the pandemic, I've seen the crime rate drastically go up near where I'm at.
Yeah.
You know, murder, for example, in Tacoma was maybe 13 to 16 people a year. It's virtually almost one a day now because of people being cooped up with this virus and everything that's going on in the world. People's morals are starting to change, and it's not for the good.
Yeah, it is. The world has changed quite a bit. I don't know. I know that if it came down to it, I would want to live. You know, I would probably go try to survive in a shelter for a while. But I live in a real rural area. I'm very self-sufficient, but you know, in a worst case scenario, I don't know, how could you live if there's a nuclear winter and all that? But I don't know. I like being alive, and I've always tried to be as self-sufficient as I can. And so that's, you know, you can put up food, and I have a photovoltaic system and make electricity and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, I don't know. It's hard to give good advice about what to do in a nuclear war because it's just so off the charts, you know.
And you're so right. Well, Professor Steve, I just want to thank you for coming back on. Maybe, you know, it might give people some ideas, and you should. Yeah, if it was me, when I'm going to tomorrow, I'm going to call the White House and just voice my opinion as a citizen that we can't get goaded into a nuclear war because we're not going to accomplish anything other than dying. And you know, on the news last night, I was watching this newscaster saying, well, if there's a nuclear exchange, go into your bedrooms, go into every window of your house and tape the windows, any air leaks shut. But then he turned around and said, well, you can't do that for more than a couple hours without venting your house because you'll suffocate. But then if you open up your windows to breathe in a couple hours, you're going to let radiation in. So what's that accomplish? I don't know. This whole scenario, Steve,
is crazy. A lot of people don't know what they're talking about out there, basically. But I do think it's a good idea if people are motivated to try to make sure that suggest that we don't get into NATO. You know, NATO should not get into a fight with Russia. And it won't happen. They're not going to start out with a nuclear launch. You know, it'd be incremental. If you send troops in there and then our NATO troops start fighting Russian troops, and then one side's going to start winning or losing. So the side that's losing, what are they going to do? Are they going to just give up? Or all the war games always get to the point where there's an initial use of a nuclear weapon to prevent some kind of defeat. And then that, you know, that can lead to a retaliatory. And so you just don't want to go there. You don't want to. That's so far so good. You know, Biden, I'd commend him for saying we're not going to, you know, get NATO involved, because that's the right thing to do.
Yeah, we need to stay out of it as much as we can. Well, sir, again, I want to thank you. And if something happens more down the road, you know, can we call you back on?
Oh, sure. I can tell you how to raise apple trees, too. I got an orchard.
Okay, that we could have a show on that. Well, my friend, you take care.
Okay, you too. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Steve. Well, anyway, tomorrow, who's our guest?
Well, tomorrow, our guest is Dr. Richard Spence. Now, he is an authority on Russian military history and all kinds of past history with that.
Well, it's going to be an interesting show again. Well, everybody, you know, again, we won't be on Mondays. I just came in this Monday, because I wanted to have Professor Steve Starr on to talk about what we were talking about. But I'm on Tuesday to Fridays. Then we have Thomas Wertmann on Saturdays and Bob Clark on Sundays. Again, we have a great new sponsor. You might want to check them out on our website. Till tomorrow, everybody have a good one and stay out of trouble.
Are you looking to learn more about survival and preparedness? Look no further. The Survival Summit has you covered. The Survival Summit has produced some of the best instructional films on wilderness survival, wilderness medical, escape and evasion, land navigation, survival communications, and much more. We also carry a wide selection of survival gear to help you on your journey to preparedness. Looking for bigger discounts? We have a monthly subscription plan that will give you immediate access to all of our films as online streaming, plus 20% off all of our products. Be sure to check us out today at thesurvivalsummit.com. That's thesurvivalsummit.com.
If I have a soul, soul. If the ice is cold. If I last forever. If I'm your man.